You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, after one of its offshore detention centres is closed by Papua New Guinea, Australia needs to find somewhere else to put people it doesn't want. But where? My guests Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the apparent flight into exile of South Sudan's vice president, Bolivia's plan for an anti-imperialist military academy, and Rio proves less hospitable than might have been anticipated, especially to French pole vaulters. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Victor Bulmer-Thomas, Associate Fellow at the US and Americas Program at Chatham House, and Phil Clark from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS. Welcome both. And we will start tonight in or on the Admiralty Islands off the north coast of Papua New Guinea, specifically on Manus, which for the last few years has housed one of the several offshore detention centres in which Australia parks unsuccessful asylum seekers. But no longer. Papua New Guinea's Supreme Court has ruled the centre unconstitutional, which means that the 854 men currently held there will need to be sent somewhere else. And as things stand, nobody appears to have any solid ideas about where. Phil, what do we make of the PNG Supreme Court's judgment? Is it surprising? It seems to have surprised Australia's government, at least.
It does, and it of course doesn't reflect Australia in a very good light that it's being shown up by the Constitutional Court in Papua New Guinea, which seems to have a clearer sense of the rule of law than the Australian government at the moment. You can see from the Australian government's reaction in the last couple of days that they seem completely blindsided by this decision. They don't know what to do with the asylum seekers who now won't be able to stay in that detention centre. There's no sense of apology from the Australian government that maybe this centre was a bad idea in the first place. So, chaos reigns in Australia's asylum seeker policy.
Not for the first time. Victor, this development, of course, comes on the heels of a release of a large cache of documents associated with another offshore detention centre, this one on Nauru, which detailed widespread abuse. As Phil says, it's not a good look for Australia. But is there a way that a country in Australia's position could be handling an issue like this and looking good? It seems to me like one of those issues in which all the options are bad.
Well, I think, difficult
at least.
I think this is one of those areas where public opinion is absolutely crucial, because we know not just from the Australian behaviour, which has been pretty shocking, but also that of this country, in the case of the camp at Calais, which is also very shocking, that there's very little that international pressure can do to get countries to behave more consistently with the international agreements to which they have signed up. But public opinion is a different matter. I think if Australian public opinion was to, agitate strongly in favour of a more humane treatment for those who will have to leave Manus and who, of course, continue to be in Nauru, that can change things. But I'm not an expert on public opinion on Australia. I bow to you two.
Well, my suspicion, Phil, speaking as one expert on Australian public opinion to another, is that we might be waiting a while for a widespread popular clamour in Australia for more generous treatment of asylum seekers.
Yes, I mean, given that this issue got almost no coverage at all in the recent election campaign, and given that the Australian public has voted in a succession of right-wing parties, and I'm thinking here particularly of the One Nation Party, which now holds the balance of power in the Senate,
I try not to think about that, especially late at night when it can cause you to wake screaming.
It seems a very reasonable reaction, Andrew. So given all of that, I would share Victor's skepticism criticism that public opinion is going to change the government's direction anytime soon. And there has been absolutely raging silence from Turnbull and most of his ministers on this issue. Turnbull, I think, personally has a more humane sort of approach to issues of refugees and asylum seekers. He's completely hamstrung by crazy right-wing nutcases in his own party. And so his maneuverability on this issue is extremely limited. So, yeah, I don't think we're going to see a very humane outcome to any of this anytime soon.
Victor, Australia's defence of the hard line it takes usually comes back to the fact that since the harder line was taken, and the facts do seem to bear this out, the boats have by and large stopped coming. So the argument is that by being ruthless enough to make it demonstrably clear that there is no route to settlement in Australia if you arrive there by boat, that will stop people from making the trip, and that will therefore save lives. I mean, if you look at the numbers from a European perspective, they seem shockingly small in terms of asylum seeker numbers. Australia now has around 1,800 people in refugee detention centres, 1,500 of those offshore. The question, I guess, being, is Australia's response disproportionate to such small numbers, or are the numbers small because the response is disproportionate?
Well, probably both. But it can't come down to a simple cost-benefit analysis the way you've described it. There are international obligations, and Australia is not meeting those.
Australia then, and I find myself in the position of taking Australia's side, which I'm not necessarily, but it has argued that its refugee intake for 2015-16 was 13,750 plus an extra 12,000 from Syria and Iraq. For a country of 23 million people, not enough?
No, you can't play the numbers game. That's not the right way. The fact is, if someone is seeking asylum, that has to be considered seriously. And the fact that they are parked temporarily in countries which are nominally not subject to Australian sovereignty is, in a sense, beside the point. This is an Australian problem, and they have to be processed, and processed quickly. That is the problem around the world, not just in Australia. It's a problem for the UK and France as well, that people are left in these refugee camps for years and years without being processed, and therefore, in some cases, legitimate claim to asylum is not being considered. Some are not legitimate claims, and that's fair enough, in which case an alternative solution has to be found. But there are international treaties. Australia has signed them, UK has signed them, France has signed them, and none of these countries are living up to their obligations. And at the moment, there is no way of using international pressure to force countries to live up to them. I mean, maybe, you know, mass demonstrations when Turnbull travels abroad. I don't know. But, I mean, something has to change.
Phil, final thought on this. Australia has to think of something to do now with these 854 men on Manus. Australia has to think of something to do, you would think, other than what it has been doing. But why is it that Australia, do you think, finds this issue so extraordinarily difficult? There seems to be no way in the Australian discourse of any kind of nuance or ambiguity in terms of refugees. It's either the people seem to think either we have to let everybody in or nobody in, and that if we let everybody in, then the world will somehow end.
No, I think all of this says some really ugly things about Australians' view of where they stand in the world. I think there is a real isolation mentality. And I think, unfortunately, even this discourse of being either swamped by Asians or swamped by Muslims still gets currency in Australian political debates. And you can see parties like One Nation mobilizing around exactly this kind of idea and getting real political traction. So I think this is forcing not just the Australian government, but the Australian people to face up to some really harsh realities about themselves and where they see themselves in the world at the moment.
Well, let's move along now and take a look at South Sudan, the world's youngest country and perhaps not coincidentally one of its most persistently troublesome. Recent months have seen fighting between factions of the military loyal to either President Salva Kiir or Vice President Riek Machar, who had audaciously disdained the convention whereby the head of state and his deputy are more or less on the same side. This worked out badly for South Sudan's people, hundreds of whom have been killed and tens of thousands of whom have fled this year, but it now appears to have worked out badly for Vice President Machar, who is reported to have left the country. Victor, the reports that Vice President Machar has left are what has emerged today. It appears that he actually left some weeks ago. What do we actually know for sure at this point?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. And I really wouldn't like to second guess. I think I'd like to make a broader point that South Sudan, whose birth travails have been probably second to none in terms of new nations, is an illustration of how easily we can fall into the trap of thinking that dividing a nation into two is somehow going to solve the problems that were there in the first place. It doesn't. It hasn't.
It very often amplifies them, in fact.
And indeed, it can amplify them. I mean, clearly, South Sudan isn't going to rejoin the North. That's now ancient history. And somehow, it has to be made less of a failure and more of a success. And that's going to involve the African Union and UN troops and all the rest of it on a much bigger scale than heretofore has taken place. Beyond that, I have no special insights, unfortunately.
Phil, Riek Machar, has he thrown in the towel, do we think, or has he decamped with a view to regrouping?
I think it's more likely to be the latter. I mean, Machar has done this kind of thing before.
Indeed, so.
A couple of years ago, he hightailed it to Nairobi. The rumor that I was sort of reading this morning was that he's gone to that well-known safe haven of the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's how desperate it's got for him. So I suspect he'll be back in South Sudan soon. But I think the bigger picture here is clearly this absolutely horrific recent escalation of the civil war in South Sudan. And really terrible atrocities against civilians in the last few weeks, which shows the really abject failure of this power-sharing arrangement. This was really the international community's solution to South Sudan after it gained independence, was to try and create a power-sharing government which would bring sort of two big factions within the rebel movement together in the hope that if they were part of the government, that would instantly resolve all of their differences. In fact, the complete opposite has happened. It's escalated those internal tensions because these actors now have to deal with each other on a daily basis. And that has caused this situation in the last few weeks. So I think the whole model of power sharing, which is one of the international community's favorite remedies to these kinds of conflicts, really has to be reconsidered in light of what's happened in South Sudan recently.
But what's the reason for the schism between the two men? Is it just a personal rivalry which has taken on these bizarre, tragic Shakespearean dimensions, or are there actually... are they themselves representing ideological or ethnic or whatever splits in South Sudan?
They do to a certain extent. I mean, there's a real ethnic dimension here between the Dinka and the Niue. But that's really just the beginning. Once you have that ethnic schism, that then it tends to map on to the division of resources and really a clash for power. So it begins with ethnicity, but it becomes a whole range of other things. Machar, on the one hand, and Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan, really do represent this enormous split. And I think the problem at independence was that these differences, which were already palpable, were never addressed. There was this hope that, again, if you just built power sharing, it would immediately magically deal with all of those problems. In fact, that clearly has not happened, and the situation is probably going to get much worse in the next couple of months.
Victor, as you were suggesting there, and not for the first time, the United Nations has failed to cover itself in glory in this scenario as well. There were reports last week that absolutely ghastly atrocities were perpetrated against foreign aid workers by Salva Kiir's troops, during which UN peacekeepers basically stationed, you know, on the next block declined to bestir themselves from their base and intervene. Is there anything that they can usefully do or should usefully be doing? Because in fairness to the UN, and it's an organization that is hamstrung by itself. It can only do what it is allowed to do by its member states. And in this particular instance, as is usually the case, some of those member states have a vested interest in it not doing anything.
Well, I always feel in these situations that you should turn first to the neighbours, and the neighbours here are all members of the African Union. Now, the African Union actually can put together a lot of resources and perhaps should do much more, and it seems it will be doing more in South Sudan. It can also call upon the UN, where there will be no difficulty in getting a resolution through the Security Council. No one's going to veto that. So the UN can play a role, but I think it has to be subordinate to the role played by the African Union. So it's probably unfair to be expecting the UN to play the leading role in this, in my view.
What do you think, Phil? Is this something that the African Union should be dealing with, or has this reached the point at which it needs, I guess, that ideally that extra authority that comes with a massive UN deployment? I mean, there has been an authorization for a new peacekeeping mandate, 4,000 more troops with a stronger mandate than previously, but South Sudan will not give permission for that 4,000 troops to deploy. I mean, how far are we, I guess, from the point at which someone should just step in anyway, regardless of what South Sudan thinks or wants?
There's a real danger of that at the moment, and I think two of the big neighbours are very worried about this escalating situation. One is the government of Sudan, which already has large numbers of troops on South Sudan's borders and has done since South Sudan's independence. The other government is Uganda, which is extremely worried by volatility north of its border. Something like 80,000 South Sudanese refugees have come across the border into Sudan in the last 10 days, and Uganda is seeing huge political and economic disruption as a result of that violence. Up until about 3 months ago, Uganda actually had very large numbers of its own troops trying to keep the belligerent parties apart in South Sudan. Uganda then had to bring its troops back across the border, hoping that South Sudanese would resolve their own situation. I think there's a serious chance now of Uganda going back in to try and bring some sort of peace there. So, yeah, I think this is likely to be an issue for the regional players. But they, of course, all have their own interests, not least the government of Sudan. So no easy resolution to this anytime soon, I don't think.
And Victor, there is all situations are different, but there does seem to be this recurring dynamic, and you could see how it played out in the 90s in Bosnia and in Rwanda, in which it was fairly clear to a lot of people that things were bad and were going to get worse. And there becomes something of a clamour for intervention from outside, whether it's the UN or the African Union or whoever, or the EU in Bosnia's case. But the intervention never seems to arrive until it's, well, if not too late, then later than it should have arrived.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there are obviously a number of countries around the world which are effectively UN protectorates, and they remain wards of court for a very long time. I mean, it can take years to get out of that
position. I did a story last year on the peacekeeping mission in Cyprus, which has been there longer than I've been alive.
Yes. Yes, well, not longer than I've been alive. the question is, are you suggesting that South Sudan should be in this position, if you like, as an almost official UN protectorate? I don't think we're quite there yet. But that's why I point to the responsibility of the neighbours. Obviously, if the neighbours can't sort it out, or if they have such divergent interests that it actually makes the situations worse, then the issue has to rise up the international agenda and become a much higher priority for the UN itself.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark. Coming up next is an anti-imperialist army school, pretty much the military equivalent of vegetarian lasagna. Bolivia thinks not.
Come on, you knew that summer couldn't last forever. It's time to think what happens in a post-lounger world. For a start, you could begin a new business, or just make the one you have better. Or you could find out how to make a fortune in TV. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the culture section, we ask, what is the future of TV? We bet on the next big formats, territories, writers, and on-screen talent.
In the design pages, we visit the furtive furniture makers, bringing Basque design into the limelight.
In the edit section, we sit down with Oscar-winning director Paolo Sorrentino for his filmic final feast, overlooking Rome.
The September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark. Now, the name of the U.S. Army School of the Americas is one that can still prompt a shudder among South Americans of a certain vintage. The Institute at Fort Benning in Georgia was where the U.S. military trained the officers of Latin American allies at a period during the Cold War when Washington was underwriting gold-braid-bedecked autocrats across the region. Now, in a belated and/or chaotic gesture of revenge, Bolivian President Evo Morales has opened a new defense academy in Santa Cruz called the School of Anti-Imperialism, it says here. Victor, is this as weird as it sounds?
Yes and no. I mean, Bolivia has good reason to be wary of U.S. imperialism. It's had
Fair enough.
Long experience of it, and it's not merely in the past. It's been in the present as well. And obviously, the drugs issue raises all sorts of clashes between Bolivia and the United States. It makes it doubly wary. But the issue is whether this is the right way to tackle it. And I'm not sure it is. Not so much the name. I think you can have an anti-imperialist military school. I don't have a problem with that. But clearly the best way for Bolivia or any other country to tackle anti-imperialism is the threat of a good example. I mean, if the country is well run and operating, if you like, on anti-imperialist principles, I would have thought that was much more effective than any amount of indoctrination in a military school. Having said that, I noted from reading the story that the leading intellectual who's going to be running the course happens to be someone I know very well, an Argentine called Attilio Borón. And I can't believe that there's any danger of, you know, massive propaganda or abuse if the program is in his hands.
Phil, you are employed by the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London, therefore well used to passing left-wing rhetoric. I wanted to run by President Morales' opening address by you. He said, "We want to build anti-colonial and anti-capitalist thinking with this school that binds the armed forces to social movements and counteracts the influence of the School of Americas, the School of the Americas, that always saw the indigenous as internal enemies." What does he mean there? Apart from the fact that he doesn't realise that the School of the Americas changed its name about 20 years ago to something else entirely.
I mean, if this were happening in an African context where this kind of rhetoric has been extremely popular over the last 30 or 40 years, I would read that as a huge emboldening of the national military and giving them a very central place in economics, in politics, in the kind of control of the population. I mean, this is, for me, one of the great kind of paradigms of this idea of a military school against imperialism is that I've never seen militaries as being very sort of liberationist enterprises. I see them as heavily armed and sort of you know, engaged in controlling populations rather than freeing them. So I mean, in an African context, this thing would seriously ring alarm bells for me.
On which subject, Victor, does Bolivia even have any natural enemies? I have looked into this a bit, and give or take Che Guevara's attempted rebellion in the late 60s, they haven't been in a proper scrap since they got beaten up by Paraguay in the Chaco War of 1932 to 35.
Well, no, that's not true. They have an ongoing dispute with Chile, which, of course, goes back to the War of the Pacific in the 19th century.
It's been pretty quiet recently.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. Bolivia lost its Pacific coastline, and it has never accepted that, even though it did sign a treaty nearly 100 years ago. And it's campaigned and agitated, and the rhetoric has actually grown stronger. And there is no immediate settlement of this problem, and it remains a real thorn in the side of the Bolivian elite, and especially of President Morales himself.
But to follow that up, though, all the rhetoric that he has made surrounding the establishment of this particular school has been around the idea of the School of the Americas and the United States in the 1980s. How politically potent is that still in Bolivia now, 30 years later?
Well, I think you should see this as theatre. And theatre is very important in politics, and especially in Bolivian politics. It's not, I think, really meant to turn out a new wave of officers that will conduct military affairs in a completely different way. And as far as I can see, Cuba is not involved in this, for example. It seems to be much more of an appeal to Venezuela and Ecuador, possibly Nicaragua. I can't remember now about that. But Cuba, which would be the serious player in this, doesn't seem to be that attracted by the idea. So I see this as a piece of political theatre. And, well, all countries, all leaders engage in that. And I'm not sure I think we should either condemn it, but we certainly shouldn't take it too seriously either.
OK, well, finally tonight, we will move along staying in South America, to Rio, where the Olympics have now been going long enough for us to start pondering what we might have learned about the host nation. For one, better pole vaulters than might have been anticipated, and two, surprisingly hostile crowds.
Compétiteur de France. Silver medalist representing
That was indeed the razzing received by French pole vaulter Renaud Lavillenie, who had had the temerity to attempt to win the event for which he had spent 4 years training. But it has not been the only such outburst. Brazilians have booed American sprinters, Russian swimmers, Ukrainian weightlifters, Argentinian tennis players, Malaysian shuttlecock whackers, and their own women's beach volleyball team, among many others. Phil, with all due respect to the fact that when the IOC start calling behaviour unacceptable, they are heaving gravel about the glasshouse with impressive abandon. IOC President Thomas Bach has called it exactly that, is it?
I was reading around about this story today, trying to find any kind of commentary by Brazilian commentators in English too, I should say. Clearly, I don't speak Portuguese, but the only commentary I could see was by outsiders who seemed to interpret this in sort of frightfully xenophobic ways about, you know, this is what you would expect of the Brazilian population. They're typically isolated from the rest of the world, and they're kind of, you know, shocked by the presence of foreigners and foreign athletes, so they simply can't handle this. Or the other line of commentary, and I think Victor will have much more insight into this than I will, is that this kind of reflects pent-up anger on the part of the Brazilian population towards their own government, towards these Olympics, towards the IOC, and they're choosing the medium of booing at foreign athletes as a way to kind of express that. I have to say, personally, I don't find any of those explanations particularly satisfactory, but maybe Victor can shed
some
light on this.
What do you think? Is it an expression of popular rage or just plain bad manners?
Well, I'm not sure I accept the hypothesis. I was in Rio just a few weeks ago, just before the Olympics, and the atmosphere was incredibly demure. It looked like it was going to be a success, and I think the Games have been a success by and large. But I've been slightly taken aback by these reports, because it's not been my experience of watching events in the Olympics, and I've seen quite a few on television. You can see, for example, another story. I mean, remember the Ethiopian middle distance runner who tripped and fell and had trouble putting on her shoe, and it was the Brazilian crowd's reaction to her misfortune that led the authorities to reinstate her in the final later on. I mean, that's a very sporting gesture on the part of the Brazilian crowd. So when you have hundreds of events, it's easy to pick on a few where the crowd has got particularly involved and particularly agitated. And Brazilians are very extrovert. I know we shouldn't use these national characteristics, because nearly always these generalizations are wrong. But Brazilians are very extrovert, and especially cariocas, the people of Rio. And of course, they get massively involved. And it's, on the whole, I think it's been lovely. And the booing, okay, that's perhaps not always the right thing, and certainly not to boo Juan Martín del Potro when he does a double fault. But let's be honest, have you seen the contrast between when a Brit like Andy Murray plays at Wimbledon and when he plays in the Davis Cup in a similar venue? It's unbelievable. I mean, people boo double faults the whole time in this country. I've witnessed it personally. So I think we should just be a little cautious about attacking the Brazilians for being unsporting.
I mean, as a general principle, though, Phil, what do we think? Have you ever booed at a sporting event, even at Hawthorn?
I have, and I think as an Australian watching these Olympics, I've been booing almost every second of every event. It's been impossible to watch. Not only are we losing, but the Brits are winning. So yeah, the whole thing is one big boo from me.
We are known for our equanimity in defeat, especially to the British, our people. Victor, what about you? Have you ever stood up and booed at a sporting competitor?
Oh, completely, yes. I mean, I'm a regular at the terraces of White Hart Lane and various other sporting events, and no sporting occasion would be complete. My last opportunity to boo was actually at the Wimbledon final, when Andy Murray said something nice about David Cameron, and I joined in the booing then, I can tell you.
On that conciliatory note, Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark, thank you for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's programme. It was produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Patrick Hun. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, 1900 Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at the same time, 1800 London. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.